This is 89.9 WWNO. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled weekend. Are you making plans? Or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place. Maybe you want to be in that number as a living legend is inducted into the Louisiana Music Hall of Fame. Perhaps you're in the mood for an art exhibit that explores the beauty and mystery of nature. Or maybe a little Halloween fun. It's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. I'm your host, Diane Mack.
All right, you ready? A little hand clapping. Oh, you got it. Here we go.
The unmistakable sound of legendary jazz pianist and entertainer extraordinaire, Ronnie Cole, who will be inducted into the Louisiana Music Hall of Fame this week.
Wow. When you go to the website and you see Louis and Sidney Bechet and Al Hurt, Pete Fountain, Fats Domino, and all of these greats from Louisiana, and then here you are amongst them, it's an honor, quite an honor.
Not bad for a boy from Chicago, for whom the piano was a diversion as a heart condition in his youth limited outdoor physical activities.
When I was feeling good, I wanted to go outside and play ball. But when I was sick, I was sometimes laid up for a month and a half, 2 months in bed. And my aunt played piano by ear, and she had a big old upright piano, and every time we'd go up there, she'd show me how to play chopsticks or with your knuckles on the black keys, and all of that jazz. And my mother and father got talking. They said, maybe we should get him a piano that would keep him from wanting to go outside and play baseball.
His father, a sanitation worker for the city of Chicago, took on extra jobs as a bartender to afford the piano and lessons. And the rest is history. Cole could tickle the ivories, and by 16 was playing gigs in the Midwest.
I went on a road with a group when I was 16. Yeah. Went down to Muncie, Indiana. And the guys, of course, were a lot older. And after about the second or third night, the owner came up to the leader of the group and says, your piano player, how old is he? He says, oh my God. He says, you didn't say anything to him, did you? He says, well, he's not old enough to be in here. You didn't say anything, did you? He says, no, I'm talking. No. He says, don't say anything to him. He was in the war, and he got shell-shocked, and anything would set him off, and that's why he's so skinny and looks the way he does. I mean, I was just as thin as a toothpick. Man, the guy never got close to me.
Cole's big break came when he met jazz trumpeter Al Hurt.
This was before he hit national stardom. And we became acquaintances. And I said, wow, you know, what a player. Then one night he came into where I was playing, and I was doing a single, a solo piano bar type thing in a very fine restaurant hotel out by O'Hare Field. And he said, Cole, he says, you know, you're as good as Liberace and Peter Nero and Roger Williams. Of course, he was drinking heavily that night. And, and he says, man, why don't you put a group together and go out and do the Carson show and do the Vegas scene and you know, start doing things like that. So I listened to him and said, all right, I'm going to do that. So I had the group, and we did the Carson show. We did the Mike Douglas shows. We did the Vegas thing. Then Al called me and said, Cole, I want you to come down to New Orleans. I want you to open up my brand new club that I'm opening up on Bourbon Street. You be my house band. We'll work opposite one another. You do one show, I'll do one. You do one, and we just go back to back and play. And we did that for about two and a half years. And then one day he said, Cole, he says, you're getting too big to be under my wings. You ought to really have your own club.
That gave birth to Cole's Corner, a celebrated club in the French Quarter. Cole involved himself in many civic and charitable causes in New Orleans and has received many awards and honors, including induction into the New Orleans Musical Legends Park in the French Quarter, the Lifetime Achievement Award, and from the French government, the Chevalier to the Order of Arts and Letters. He's performed his eclectic jazz style for 6 presidents and Pope John Paul II on his trip to New Orleans. Most memorable is his arrangement and performance of Amazing Grace.
It was the first time that I ever played the arrangement the way I had written it and envisioned it, and that was with a choir and with orchestra. I had done it many, many times with orchestra, a few times with a choir, but never with the two together. And with the choir singing a secondary part of a little bit of Jesus Christ Superstar, a little bit of the Hallelujah Chorus at the beginning, and the Lord's Prayer at the end.
At 81 now, Cole lives in Slidell and continues to perform concerts and festivals. And he is caring for the love of his life, his wife, Gardner, who suffered a stroke 2.5 years ago. He says he has no plans to stop playing.
I'll stop when I drop, but then I'll probably push the lid up and say, give me 4 more choruses, please.
This weekend, Ronnie Cole will be inducted into the Louisiana Music Hall of Fame. He will be celebrated with a brunch and live entertainment where he will perform with special guest. Celebrate the Legend, Ronnie Cole, will be held in the Slidell Municipal Auditorium Sunday from 1:30 to 3:30. More info at lmhof.org. Jacqueline Bishop is one of New Orleans' most respected and collected artists, with work in important private and public collections around the country. The Philadelphia Academy of the Fine Arts, for instance, recently acquired several of her paintings. Jacqueline Bishop opens an exhibition of new work, Against the Tide, Saturday at the Arthur Roger Gallery, 432 Julia Street. WWNO's Fred Kasten has more.
Jacqueline Bishop can see the seeds of Against the Tide in work she did while in graduate school at Tulane in the 70s.
One painting in particular called One Tide Old, and it was about 6 feet long, and it was of empty beach chairs in a kind of a desecrated beach scene where you know that humans had been there, and I had picked up a lot of fish skeletons and fragments of dead sea life on the beach and applied that to the canvas. And so I had all of these sea creatures from the Gulf on the surface of the canvas, and then I did the actual painting over that, and it was kind of beautiful, you know, incorporating the human with the non-human in art.
A combination that continues to interest Jacqueline Bishop, and found expression in the 80s through many paintings of birds.
Started painting birds and needed more research, more information about the birds, and did more research. And after a period of time, found out some of the birds that were in my paintings were indeed extinct. And that had a profound effect on me and my vision about my work, about the world. And about that time in the mid-80s was when I heard about the assassination of Chico Mendes, the Brazilian rubber tapper. They assassinated him for trying to stop cattle ranchers and burning and everything of landscape that was usable, necessary, and then of course became desert after they desecrated it. So that had an impact on me as well, and it was about the same time that I found out about the extinct birds.
To deepen her knowledge of Chico Mendes and his philosophies concerning humans and the natural world, Bishop learned Portuguese and traveled frequently to Brazil to talk directly with his friends and family and see the rainforest up close. She also made numerous birdwatching trips with ornithologists to South and Central America and along the Gulf Coast.
I learned so much about the birds through the scientists and through my birdwatching friends that it became more than just color and content. It was politics. And there was still the poetry of the natural world and of birds because, you know, let's face it, they're beautiful. But so many of them were going extinct for political reasons. And that fit into my vocabulary, my visual vocabulary.
The birds that populate Jacqueline Bishop's paintings often roost in trees that take on decidedly anthropomorphic forms.
When you're living in the rainforest in Brazil for 2 or 3 weeks at a time in a tent, and you're surrounded by only trees, and you don't see humans for 2 or 3 weeks, the trees have a presence, a very distinct presence, and it becomes more of a living organism with a presence, with a personality, and you can feel it, and probably, you know, they become more human and they become depicted that way in the paintings.
Which are also replete with orchids, fish, a variety of mammals, and some indication of human presence, all juxtaposed in surreal combinations and rendered in a style that acknowledges Jacqueline Bishop's strong affinity for 17th century Dutch and Flemish painting.
I've always loved 17th century Dutch still life, Flemish painters, the Florentine painters, Renaissance. And there's a lot of information when you go back to the Renaissance paintings. There's so many birds and flora and fauna that are extinct, but they are in those paintings. They are recorded in those paintings. So the paintings take on another meaning, not just a beautiful still life, but a recording of the past.
Jacqueline Bishop's paintings often evoke a feeling of being fluid in time, replete with icons of the past, while presaging the unhappy results in the near future of current destructive behavior by humanity. A good example from Against the Tide is the painting Queen Bess Island. Inspired by a pelican nesting ground of that name near Grand Isle that got smothered in oil after the BP disaster in April 2010.
There are silhouettes of birds in the trees, and they could be oil birds or they could just be silhouettes, because sometimes when birds are up higher in the tree, you cannot identify the species. Or if it's at the end of the day and you look through your binoculars, you cannot identify the species. So it's a viewer's interpretation.
And that's a recurring theme as well in your work. You're not quite sure. It could just be the light, or it could be something more sinister that's darkened these birds or these animals of various stripes.
Well, that's probably where some of the darkness comes in the work. We really never know for sure what's going on, do we? I mean, when something seems like it's there, maybe it's really not there at all. Nothing is what it seems. Nothing is what it is. And we find out, I mean, just even the dialogue between the tide coming in, which comes in, you know, and out twice a day, and that dialogue with the sun and the moon is a very important dialogue for us, but no one's listening.
Do you ever dream these paintings? Do they ever show up in your dreams?
I have had dreams. I see them when I'm in the shower. I see them when I'm driving. You never know when these visions appear. I draw them down and they become a painting. Not all of them become paintings, but if I carry it through, it usually becomes a painting.
Jacqueline Bishop celebrates the opening of a new exhibition of paintings and works on paper and fabric, Against the Tide, with a reception Saturday night at the Arthur Roger Gallery, 432 Julia Street, starting at 6. For 89.9 WWNO, I'm Fred Kasten.
You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO. I'm your host, Diane Mack, extending a heartfelt thank you to everyone who called in a pledge of support during our fall membership drive last week. Thanks to you, the drive was a success. If you didn't get a chance to pledge your support, you still can by calling 800-286-7002 or WWNO.org. Do you believe in ghosts? Yes? No? Well, I hear there's paranormal activity going on at NOMA, the New Orleans Museum of Art, on Halloween.
Photography has this kind of otherworldly, extrasensory form of perception and often captures things that the human eye cannot see. And photographs of ghosts are evidence of just another example of that.
That's Russell Lord, NOMA's Freeman Family Curator of Photographs. And spirit photography will be the subject of a special talk, There's a Ghost in My Photograph, as Lord explores evidence of otherworldly spirits he lucked upon during a shopping trip across the pond.
We recently had the good fortune to come across a group of photographs of ghosts from the 1930s. I found them in an antiquarian bookshop in England and bought them for the collection. These photographs come out of a group of material from the Great Metropolitan Spiritualist Association, which was a group of spirit enthusiasts who held seances in London, England in the 1930s. And probably the most major figure associated with that group was Sir Arthur Conan Doyle of Sherlock Holmes fame. And Conan Doyle was a huge fan of spirit photography and wrote a vigorous defense of the truth of spirit photography and its uses in the 1920s. Spirit photography really covers a very broad range of pictures of picture making in photography. The most kind of obvious example are pictures of ghosts, pictures of spirits, and the ones that we'll be showing people on Wednesday. You will see these kind of half-present diaphanous figures floating in the air, hovering above very real people, concrete people, who are sitting around a table. And what you're looking at is actually a seance where they have supposedly conjured up this spirit who is floating above them. And although they, in the picture, in the photograph, don't seem to be making eye contact with the spirit, and that's because we assume that they can't see it, the other assumption is that photography can see it.
But is it real or a manipulated photograph? Lord leaves that door open to interpretation.
That's a good question. I really became interested in photography's relationship to the world of spirit because one of my main areas of expertise is the invention of photography. And when you think back to how shocking it must have been for the earliest viewers of photographs to kind of see the world appear fully formed magically on a piece of metal or paper, it must have been mind-bogglingly strange. And a lot of people attributed that kind of magical, instantaneous appearance to the world of the spirit. In fact, many of the earliest photographers were accused of dabbling in, quote, the dark arts. And this is a kind of theme that comes up quite often in photography. However, after photography had circulated throughout the world, people started to realize that what it recorded was something that had actually been in front of the camera at a particular time. So it became closely aligned with this concept of truth or reality. And what's fascinating to me about spirit photography is that certain clever practitioners or believers, let's call them, created these pictures of spirits and using photography. So it became this kind of indisputable proof of the existence of spirits because, of course, what appears in a photograph had to be true. So I think what we're really exploring by looking at these photographs is photography's relationship to truth, which, of course, is coming under greater fire today with the advent of digital technology, and then our own human belief. You know, what do we choose to believe? Why do we choose to believe the things that we believe? Those are the big questions.
The photos may challenge your imagination, making believers out of those who might not believe, and vice versa.
In some spirit photographs, what you're looking at is very clear, or what the photographer wanted you to see is very clear. There is a definable ghost, and then there are real people sort of functioning in the world that the ghost is hovering above. And then there are other kinds of spirit photographs that are much more abstract, and we do have one of those that we'll be showing as well. It looks like a picture of almost nothing. There's a few kind of bright flashes in the picture. And when you flip this picture over on the back, it reveals that what you're looking at was a negative that was wrapped in a box and left on a table during a seance and not exposed to light at all. And when it was developed, these inexplicable bright flashes were on the plate. So the question is, how did this happen? How did this negative that was never exposed to light come to possess these bright flashes of light on the surface of the negative? And of course, what the spiritualists would tell you is that, well, those were the spirits dancing across the photographic chemistry in the darkness. So I think there's a fun range here for us to explore, from concrete and figurative pictures to the abstract concept of the movement of spirits in the world.
You'll be able to touch mounted photos and other items from the Great Metropolitan Spiritualist Association during Russell Lord's talk, "There's a Ghost in My Photograph." There will not be a medium seeking to talk with spirits of the dead. However, you will be seated in a circle, seance style, as you explore spirit photography of the 1930s. The talk, which should last about an hour, begins at high noon tomorrow at the New Orleans Museum of Art, giving you plenty of time to make your exit before sundown, when the spirits of Halloween come alive. Are we having fun yet? If that's a little too spooky, we have something extra in our Lanyap Corner. Cajun cuisine and Bayou culture will be celebrated Saturday and Sunday at the Louisiana Swamp Fest. The event is hosted by the Audubon Zoo. Included will be Cajun crafts and cooking demonstrations, Bayou heritage presentations, and entertainment. More information on the festival is available online at audubon.org. Artist and writer Alex Beard will read from his books, The Jungle Grapevine, Monkey See, Monkey Draw, and Crocodile's Tears, as part of the New Orleans Museum of Art's Story Quest, where professional authors, actors, and artists spark imaginations, creativity, and the love of reading. StoryQuest takes place in Noma's Museum Shop, Saturday at 11 a.m. Family activities will be offered after each StoryQuest to encourage museum exploration. And Irvin Mayfield and New Orleans Jazz Orchestra are celebrating their 10th anniversary with the Nojo 10, a series of events scheduled throughout the city. On Friday at 8 p.m., a tribute to renowned New Orleans pianist James Booker, featuring special guest at Irvin Mayfield's iClub. More info at thenojo, NOJO.com. That's our show for this week. Inside the Arts is a production of WWNO. Our program is archived at WWNO.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette next week at 1 p.m. when we'll go inside the arts. I'm Diane Mack.